Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google. Episode 2 for August 8th, 2009. PubSub, HubBub. This Week in Google is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for Audible today and get your free book at audiblepodcast.com/Google. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. It's time for This Week in Google, the show that covers all things cloud and Google-based. Once again, we bring together a great panel, starting with Gina Trapani of smarterware.org, the creator of Lifehacker and a hacker on her own right. Hi, Gina.
Hey, Leo. Good afternoon.
Great to have
you
back.
Yep. Great to be here.
Show was number one this week, I'm proud to say, in iTunes. Also here, Jeff Jarvis, the author of What Would Google Do, journalist and blogger at buzzmachine.com. What is that? What is that shirt that you're showing us, Jeff?
I bought it, a Google t-shirt.
You bought a Google t-shirt. So we now have team uniforms, ladies and gentlemen, for the show. I'm happy to hear that. That's wonderful. We really thank you all for listening. It was a great response to our first episode. In fact, as I said, number one on the iTunes store briefly. And I think we're number three as of this recording. So that's just a nice feeling when a show is so rapidly embraced. So we appreciate it. We hope we will live up to your expectations. There's a lot to talk about this week. And I don't know, are you guys up for what we talked about last week? Jeff, you do a Jeff's stat of the week?
Sure.
A number of the week, and Gina's tip of the week?
Absolutely, I am prepared.
And I'll be a tool. I'll have the Google. I'll highlight a Google tool every week. So we'll do that towards the end of the show. But let's start by talking about the Twitter / Live Journal / Facebook / Google DDoS that started on Thursday, and actually for Twitter, as for all I know, is still going on. Twitter, for some reason, suffering more than all the rest. I thought it'd be good to get somebody who's been covering this on the show. In fact, we're going to call in Eleanor Mills right now, who's been covering this for news.com. Hi, Eleanor. It's Leo with Jeff Jarvis and Gina Trapani.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you've been covering this DDoS since it started. What time did it start?
It started, I think it was Thursday night.
Thursday night? Okay.
Well, actually, Thursday during the morning.
Morning.
But it went on through much of the day.
And in fact, if you went to Twitter's blog, even as late as last night, Friday night, they still said, well, we're still being attacked.
They're still dealing with it. That's true.
Are they dealing with it now? We're recording Saturday afternoon. Is it still?
Yeah. No, when I checked earlier, the site was up.
Okay.
But again, it depends what geography you're in.
Okay. So what happened?
Well, it was a distributed denial of service attack. And it took Twitter down for hours so that none of its users could get to the site. And it was confusing. You know, they've had their reliability issues in the past. But then Facebook reported they were having some issues, not the entire site down for everyone, but just not accessible to certain people at certain times. But they fended it off pretty quickly. Then it turned out that it was an attack that was targeting those sites as well as Google's Blogger and Google Sites and Live Journal, which is a blogging site. And the companies behind the scenes were getting together and cooperating, trying to figure out what's happening. It turned out that there was one common thread to all of the sites, and it was a user who had accounts on all of those sites, and that user's page and pages were being attacked.
So it wasn't a general DDoS against these sites. It was an attack on this guy.
Yeah, exactly. They were trying to, whoever was doing it was trying to take that person's sites down.
Why?
Because, well, that's a good question. I mean, the guy is a blogger in Georgia.
Not Atlanta, Georgia.
No.
The former Soviet Republic of Georgia.
Exactly, yeah. And he has been pretty vocal in his, writings about pro-Georgian and anti-Russian, or, complaining about the Russian military and the way they've been dealing with things in the Caucasus region. And so the speculation is that he was targeted by, for his political stance and for his writings.
He himself has actually said
that he thinks it's Russia.
By the Russians, by the Russian government.
Yeah.
Was it a botnet that was doing the DDoSing?
Probably, yeah. That's typically how they're done. That's the way that you can really take a site down, is you have to get tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, even millions of computers that have been compromised.
And an interesting side note to this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I had read that after the botnet attacked these sites, that spam was going out with links to this guy's various sites on YouTube and LiveJournal and Twitter and Facebook, and people who were clicking the links in spam were further unwittingly attacking these sites.
Actually, yes, it was a two-pronged attack, probably by the same people. And I think it may have started out first with the spam, that spam emails were sent that looked like they came from this person's, email account. But they weren't. He claims that they were spoofed. He didn't send them out.
Oh, so they didn't say, "Oh, these are pictures of Lady Gaga." They said, "Go." What? How do you pronounce it?
Shimiu. Something like that. Yeah.
They said, "This is hi Shimiu here. Please click my link.
Click my link. Go to my YouTube page. Go to my Twitter page." And the links went to his Twitter and YouTube and blogger page. But that was not enough to cause a denial of service.
So was all the traffic just plain old HTTP traffic? It wasn't a SYN flood or anything like that?
We're not sure. And they're not, the companies that were,
they don't want to say anything.
They're not saying exactly. They're not saying what they did to stop it.
But they worked together in concert to stop it.
They sure did.
Interesting that Twitter suffered the brunt of it, probably because its infrastructure wasn't so strong.
Right. Well, Google's built to handle searches and all sorts of, millions and millions of searches per second and whatnot. And they've got a huge infrastructure, lots of data centers, bandwidth up the wazoo. They're fine. LiveJournal was taken down, but they're a smaller company. And Twitter has, grown so fast that they're struggling to keep up with just regular growth, let alone a huge concerted attack like this.
They can't keep up with Oprah, let alone Shizhuizhu.
Exactly.
Facebook, though, came out pretty well. I mean, I know his page was down, and there was some slowness, but they seemed to come out.
Yeah, what they did to handle it is they cut off access to his page from everyone outside of his geographical region. So they kept, they allowed people in his, in that region of the Eastern Europe to be able to get to his page.
That's counterintuitive, because I thought the attacks were coming from Eastern Europe.
They were, but they were able to sort of load balance and say, okay, well, let's allow, people who really need to get to his site to get to it. Whereas, I was in San Francisco trying to get to it yesterday and I couldn't. So they figured, for right now to deal with, the attack, let's sort of, control it that way.
This, by the way, the guy's name is, he's a 34-year-old economics professor named Georgi. He doesn't,
yes,
he doesn't say his real name. He's a refugee from Georgia.
He supposedly lives in Tbilisi now. That's what he's told several journalists over there.
Boy, I can't think of a single case of this kind of thing happening.
This is the first that I know of, and I've been covering internet, and technology stuff for since 94, and this is the first time I've heard of an individual's account being targeted like this by a denial of service attack that took, a whole site down. Usually it's a site getting targeted, a blog site or, a company because of, whatever reason. A lot of it's usually political too.
Well, Eleanor, I want to thank you for giving us an update on the inside story on this. It must have been a very interesting story to cover.
Oh, it was fascinating. And when, details were emerging, it was very exciting. And when we found this piece of information out, it was like, whoa, one person being attacked. How intense.
Yeah, I've never seen that happen before.
Well, the irony is they wanted to shut him down and they wanted to silence him, as a Facebook CSO was, chief security officer was pointing out. But yet now he's bigger and higher profile than ever.
The Streisand effect, once again. Eleanor's column is called Insecurity Complex. It's at CNET's news site, news.cnet.com.
Yes.
And a great, I read it all the time, really useful blog about the security issues and stories like this. Thank you, Eleanor.
Well, thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Okay.
So what do you think, Gina and Jeff? I wanted to get the facts out before we talk discussed about it. I think a couple of issues that come up in my mind. One is we were seeing howls of pain from Twitter users, but not just regular Twitter users. There was one company that was doing a product launch on Thursday and planned to use Twitter as their primary way of launching this product.
Welcome to the internet.
The cloud is not as reliable as they might have thought.
Well, you know, Leo, one thing that occurred to me in the story is how much these tools aren't just playthings. They are political.
Yeah.
In Iran, I saw a story late today that one of the indictments in the so-called trials in Iran specifically lists Facebook and Twitter and Google language tools as co-conspirators.
Wow.
And so the fear is that you have political entities that are going to go after these things that are just part of our lives, and we look at it very differently.
I mean, Google survived this pretty well, which is, I don't know if it's because they were attacked less or because they have more bandwidth than God, probably the latter more than the former. Facebook, which also has a lot of bandwidth, responded very quickly. Twitter kind of showed its weakness here.
Yeah, well, I mean, but we're all kind of used to Twitter being down, right?
I guess so.
I mean, the thing that struck me about this story, just because I'm a, you know, whatever, kumbaya singing hippie, is that I just love that all these companies got together and worked together to figure this out.
Neat.
Like, it made me feel like, oh, hey, you know, there should be sort of a federation of big internet companies that have, you know, some sort of established infrastructure so that when these things do come up, and they will come up again, you know, that they can help one another out. The totally unrelated to this DDoS, Gawker Media's sites got attacked this week as well, which publishes Lifehacker. And it was, you know, somebody going after consumerist.com, which is a site that, you know, does reviews and outs companies for bad things that they do. Anyway, you know, I felt so bad for our tech team. I mean, they were just desperate and up all night and just analyzing gigabytes and gigabytes of logs, trying to figure out what was going on. And I mean, you know, obviously that this was a specific to Gawker, but it would have been nice for them to, you know, if it had been happening across sites, to have that sort of support and cooperation. So I really like that the companies got together and tried to figure out what was up.
People don't realize how painful this is when this happens to a company. I mean, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just offline. I mean, when your business is being online, to be offline.
Yeah. And you just feel like you're bleeding, you know, thousands of dollars every second that ticks by. It's just horrible for everyone, you know, and the poor sysadmins, talk about a thankless job. I mean, you never know you have sysadmins until something goes wrong, right?
Right. When we're down, I know I thank my sysadmin and I scream, I holler. I say, Bear, we're down. I mean, it's like that old video, the website is down, where it's just panic time. It's just panic time. Is there any lesson to be learned? Is this going to happen? I suspect it is going to happen more. Is it something that means people should be less trusting of cloud computing, Gina?
You know, I think these are growing pains. I do think that people should have sort of healthy skepticism and about cloud computing in general, and should know what things are possible, what terrible things can go wrong, what things are possible. But, you know, these are growing pains. I mean, I think that these things will happen less, and you know, it's an arms race, right? Things go wrong. Companies figure out how to fix them and we go forward. I mean, there are going to be some bad days. The internet, you know, isn't always going to work the way you expect if you're going to launch your product. And it's good to have, you know, plan Bs. I don't think that we should all get off the internet because we think that.
Yeah.
You know,
let's all get off the internet.
Crashing down.
It's over. I'm giving up. Yeah. I'm going home. I'm going to take my podcast and I'm going home.
Leo, I remember in the early days of blogging, or what we thought were the early days, Glenn Reynolds, at Instapun, it had a ready-made backup site always at the ready because the internet, you know, things crashed all the time then.
We should still do that.
Yeah, we actually should.
That's not a bad idea.
I mean, really smart, yeah.
That's really what happened to Twitter, is that it had a single point of failure. They didn't have all these data centers.
The single point of failure was the web. But because Twitter is an API and you can get to Twitter through elsewhere, that should be its strength. Right. It's a strength against Iranian censors, is that I can get to Twitter without calling on Twitter.com.
Right.
So somehow that should become their strength. And the irony is it was their weakness because, of course, nothing could call their servers because they were all calling Twitter.com.
Well, it was almost a packet storm because when Twitter.com went down and the API started failing, and then people like FriendFeed and I know Identica, I know Evan Prodromo at Identica said, you know, we're making it worse by hitting them again and again, trying to get our feeds over there. We're just going to turn it off until this goes away. I mean, it creates its own problem.
Yeah, it does. And you know, it makes me kind of dream of a time when maybe the cloud will be more distributed, where people will run, and this will segue easily into the next thing we're going to talk about, but there'll be hubs that you know, take Twitter data and store it and also can serve API, you know, API calls and requests, where like if Twitter.com proper is down, that there's some sort of mechanism, sort of like BitTorrent, like peer-to-peer, you know, spreading the cloud across different domains and different servers. I mean, we're a long way from that, but that's something I would love to see, you know, 5-10 years down the road.
Yeah.
Gina, I think it goes even more toward the architecture of content in the future, is you're not going to go to the notion of a destination site as much. The content itself is going to be distributed all over. It's aggregated and displayed in different ways through APIs. And so you may not even know what site you're going to. You're not going to a site anymore. The notion of doing that means you get less traffic.
Well, in a way, we're already there. I mean, it started with RSS, but I mean, that's half or less of Twitter's traffic is on the web page. Most of it's through, you know, TweetDeck and Tweety and other API-based clients, right?
Shouldn't they have some reliable side door to the data then?
That seems like it. But Twitter, for some reason, has had such trouble with their engineering. I don't want to make this a bad, you know, bash Twitter episode. But it's not surprising that
this weekend fail whale.
Yeah. I mean, really, come on. A lot of people are now really relying on Twitter. The pain people were feeling on Thursday was really kind of fascinating.
But, you know, imagine a TweetDeck that gets all your friends' updates and stores them locally and pushes your updates out. And so, you know, you're in TweetDeck, Twitter now is down, but you post an update and TweetDeck says, oh, hey, you know, or whatever client you're using, hey, Twitter.com is down, but I know who your followers are. I know who your friends are. So I'm going to push your updates out to them and then I'll just queue things up. Right. And when Twitter's back up, we'll push it to the central hub. But my friends, so a distributed situation where like my friends can get my updates and my followers can get mine. And, you know, Twitter.com, it doesn't necessarily have to be up at that moment. And when it does come up, it syncs, sort of like, you know, offline email, essentially,
Isn't that what Dave Weiner's been talking about in trying to get off the notion of Twitter on one company?
Yes.
That if TweetDeck and Tweety had a federation that they shared at that moment and they grew, you've just seen the start of the architecture of the cloud. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think Weiner is right on with that. I really love the idea of being able to, you know, be less dependent on Twitter.com proper and being able to, you know, for a few different Twitters to all sync back to, you know, I'm not trying to take their business, but sync back to Twitter in a cloud and not be dependent on the service actually being up. But it would make DDoS attacks like that much less possible.
Federation.
Yep.
Isn't that what Wave does? That's kind of the whole idea behind Wave, is that anybody can run a Wave server. The servers are federated. Is Wave completely decentralized?
From what I understand, it is. So anybody can install a server and the servers talk to one another. So and that's one of the great things about Wave is that it is federated and distributed and that it's not dependent on Google being up.
Let's talk about Wave a little bit. I presume that's the story that you were talking about, Ginar. Story number two. And I've asked Anil Dash to come on the show. Maybe he'll be on next week if his schedule allows. This is the second week in a row we've talked about an article from Anil, so I think we have to bring him on. Last week we talked about his push button web, the pub sub, hub bub. And in fact, a little later on, we'll talk about the fact that Google Reader has now adopted, it made it a little bit easier to do push button web.
Yep.
This week, he published an article that I thought was fairly challenging and controversial, and I'd love to get your opinions on it. It's titled, What Works? The Web Way versus the Wave Way. And he's really saying that, you know, there's a lot of hype, obviously, for Wave. This is going to replace email. But he says that Wave really is not going to succeed because the way Wave does it is incompatible with the things that have made the World Wide Web successful. Does that make sense to you?
You know, it does make sense to me because let's talk about how do we all learn how to build websites, right? First, we learned a little HTML and that worked. Cool. Okay. And then we figured out, oh, this robots.txt file tells search engines how to work. Okay. That we can do. Great.
It was all incremental stuff.
All incremental. All these little things. We just look a little, oh, here's an RSS feed and that shows up in this reader. Cool. All incremental, very easily hackable.
It's true. I'm thinking about when I got into podcasting, I was already offering for download audio. And somebody said, well, if you create an RSS feed, it'll be this thing called a podcast. And I was able to do that in a day or two. He says, you've got to be able to do it. It has to be a weekend sized problem if it's going to succeed. Something you could do in a weekend.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's very true. Right. So I think.
But doesn't that make it trivial? It means we can only do trivial things if it can only be incremental, and it can only be done in a weekend.
Well, it does. It does. It's a little trivial in that things happen slowly and like little bit by bit. But his argument is that these are the ways that things get deployed across the web, you know, widespread deployment across the web. Because, look, Wave is going to be awesome. It's going to come out. We're probably going to use it for the show. We're all going to use it. And
but it's going to be hard to use.
For people who can't install their own server. I mean, you know, you have to have people who can install the server and get that running or get access to a Wave server. And that's fine. I mean, the people setting up a server isn't that big a deal. But, you know, companies are going to want Wave functionality on their sites without getting Google involved necessarily.
Right.
I mean, I think that that's a reasonable thing. They're going to say we want real time technologies on our site. We don't necessarily want to do it the way that Wave does it. We don't want to drop this JavaScript from the Wave server onto our, you know, we want to do it our way. We want to do it the web way. We want to host this stuff on our servers. I think that that's a reasonable thing to want.
I think that's all true, Gina, but isn't it also true that certain things, when they're fundamental to the web, are necessarily more complicated, right? Apache, Linux, the browser itself, were not weekend projects. They were important.
But they were incremental.
Yes.
I would disagree to this extent. You didn't have a little tiny bit of a web server and tried one little thing and then it grew and grew and grew.
Well, but Apache, in fact, even means Apache. The name Apache comes from Apache web server. It was patched and patched and patched again and patched again. It was.
But who says Wave couldn't be that?
Well,
the question, what Anil's saying is that, and I don't disagree with him, the best way for Wave to spread is if it were a weekend project. However, maybe it just isn't in the first blush.
Right.
Maybe to get this fundamental cinder block layer in there is going to be hard, and then it becomes incremental on top of that.
Well, he also raises the issue of what I would call the network effect. He talks about Metcalfe's law. He says there has to be value before everybody has upgraded. In other words, people aren't going to move to you said that last week, Gina. Wave's cool, but if nobody you know is using it, it's completely silly. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, unless you use it to publish web content, which you can do. You could have a small group, let's say a newspaper newsroom, could use Wave to publish
an
instant group could use Wave to collaborate in a set group in 10 people and then use that to publish to the web. That becomes a demonstration project for the value of Wave.
Yeah.
Am I wrong, Gina? I mean, you know more about this than I do by miles.
You know, from the way that it works now, at least with the sandbox, and I don't know how if this is going to work, always work this way. But what you can do is you can drop a little wavelet onto a web page so people can have a real-time conversation on an existing web page. So say I'm not using Wave and I happen upon a web page that's using a wavelet. The message right now, or at least when I saw it, was like, you need to be logged into Wave to do this, right? So then suddenly, you know, it's incumbent on you to create an account or have a Wave
That's
account.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it might be a problem, but it's also a good way to get people to, you know, to adopt this new protocol. And Wave isn't just a product, right? It's a server. It's a protocol, and it's an open source product, and anybody could build, you know, another Wave server product or client product to the protocol. But Anil is arguing that that's a really monstrous thing. It's too hard. It's too hard to take on.
Well, some of this is.
I saw a blog from Garrett Rogers who disagreed with Anil, and it's on our wiki list, saying it's too soon to make these judgments and that there's still something bigger there.
Well, that's about what I was about to say is Anil and, well, really none of us have really installed a Wave server or looked at what it would involve installing a Wave server. In fact, very few of us even have any experience with Wave. Aside from the kind of a little bit of, you know, here and there, I've tried it with somebody else. So we don't know, really. Part of this is we just don't know yet. But he does. I'm glad he wrote the articles because I think it's important to point out that the things that have succeeded on the web have been, for the most part, maybe you take LampStack out, but for the most part, small, incremental, easy to implement things that can be accreted to make something extremely powerful. But wavelets might make that possible. If I could embed a little thing on iGoogle, of course, I have to say my experience with things like Latitude don't give me a lot of confidence in Google's ability to execute something that really is that simple. I don't know about you, but Latitude's never worked well for me.
I don't like to broadcast my location, so I've actually never tried. I've had too many weird people email me to want to broadcast my location at any point.
But yesterday, I bright kited.
You keep the bike behind you so you can get away fast.
That's right. Get away fast.
She's ready to run. Yesterday, I bright kited my actual address by accident. He's stupid. But that's part of the problem with these technologies. You're probably right not to install it. But when I, Latitude. To use Latitude, it's very weird, and I hope that this isn't something that Google's going to do more. To use Latitude, you need to embed it as an iGoogle gadget. I mean, you can use it on your phone, but if you can use it on the web, you embed it as an iGoogle gadget, and it's within the gadget that you add friends and all that. And it, for the first 20 times I tried to add people, it didn't even load the page. Mm. So there are some execution issues. Now, the Rasmussens seem like they know what they're doing, so maybe that won't happen to Google Wave. I guess it's all speculative. We should probably just wait and see when Wave comes out.
It is, but Anil has been sort of the head of the blogging revolution and the kind of acquisition of the deployment of all the technologies around blogging for years now, since 2000. So he's seen people take on publishing technologies and take on feeds. I mean, we're now to a point where pretty much. Anyone who has any kind of savvy and knows what a feed is, that's kind of a big deal. I remember conversations years ago where people were just like, feeds are too hard, XML is too hard. And now, everyone's, not everyone, but a large percentage of the mainstream population knows what feeds are, which is impressive. So, I don't know. I am a student in the school of Anil Dash, I will admit.
Well, okay, but I will point out that he also, as somebody who's tied to the blogging platform, I love Anil, maybe we'll get him on and he could defend himself. But maybe he's also, as I have been in the past, somebody who is tied to an older technology that maybe isn't really fully in the, the corner of a new technology. It's not not unusual that happens also.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
But he makes excellent points. Do read the blog post. We'll get Anil on, and he can talk about it and defend himself. Some news in the Pub/Sub/Hub/Bub. You talked last week about adding push button web to your blog, right, Gina?
Yes, I did. So last week I was talking about Pub/Sub/Hubbub, and let's just all say I love those guys who are building it, but that is it's the worst name.
Can
it's
you
so
explain
hard to say,
what it is?
Say.
What does it mean?
Pub/Sub/Hubbub puts a hub between publishers and subscribers. So it lets a publisher notify essentially a middle server that say, hey, I have new content. And then that hub goes out to subscribers and on a notification basis, not a polling basis, says, hey, here's new content. It pushes new content across the web real time without polling, without asking over and over again, does your feed have new content? Does your feed have new content? So the publisher saves bandwidth. The subscribers get the new content more quickly, practically real time. And in fact, during the crunch up demo that Brad Fitzpatrick and Brett Slatkin did, they said that at one point while they were testing, they wound up chatting with one another through the hub. They didn't mean to,
because it was so real time.
It was so fast. Yeah.
You said no latency.
Yeah, there's no latency. So the first tiny deployment of Pub/Sub/Hubbub went out this week, and these are Google guys who are building Pub/Sub/Hubbub. But this is something that's completely independent of Google products. This is like an open protocol that uses very simple technologies that we all know: XML, HTTP. They got together with the Google Reader guys. This is I guess the advantage of working at Google is that you can just kind of call up the team that does a product, and said when Google Reader users share items, notify friend feed. They basically hooked up Pub/Sub/Hubbub access between Google Reader and friend feed, and friend feed is built by former Google folks, right? So right now in Google Reader, if you share an item, it shows up in your friend feed page immediately, and you can try it. I did browser window side by side. It shows up as fast as an instant message.
So normally, for instance, if you tweet and your tweets are sent to friend feed polls Twitter on a schedule, They're limited by the API as to how many times they can pull and by how much, I presume, by how much they can pull. So there's a delay. And in fact, there can be quite a long delay between you tweeting and it showing up in friend feed. This isn't poll.
This is notification.
This is push. So is it essentially a ping that Google Reader sends to friend feed saying, I've got new data for you?
It pings a server, the hub, between Google Reader and friend feed.
Oh, there's an intermediary.
There's an intermediary, right. And that's the magic, right? That there's the hub is the intermediary. And on a given feed, right now the intermediary happens to be an open Google-hosted hub. But in the future, when there are more hubs, a given feed can ping several different hubs. So if a hub goes down, other hubs will get the information. So the publisher notifies the hub, and then the hub notifies a subscriber, which in this case happens to be friend feed. But this is something I would love to see. I use Twitter feed to push out my blog headlines to Twitter, and they poll right now. So like, I would love to see Twitter feed use this, because then you publish a blog post and it would be out on Twitter immediately. And it would save on Twitter API calls, which are way expensive right now.
Right. Expensive in computing power, not price.
Expensive in that you only get 150 per hour. Twitter's off and down, all that stuff.
So later in the show, you're going to explain to us how we can do this ourselves.
Yeah, because FeedBurner has built-in support for this. So I'm gonna tell you how to turn it on your FeedBurner feed.
So easy, she could describe it in a podcast.
Yes.
That's how easy it is, but then we'll also send you to her post, and then you can read all the details.
Sure.
David Pogue wrote in his in the New York Times recently that Google's response to Apple pulling the Google Voice app or blocking the Google Voice app from the iPhone store is to write it as a web application, to use HTML5 now that that's so well supported by Safari on the iPhone. And there's, I don't think there's any way that Apple can stop it. That's an interesting...
Not a phone. It's what we said last week. This is what this is really about. It's the web. And I still think that maybe naive of me, but I think this is the real net neutrality debate, is that if you try to keep an app off, well, screw you. We're going to go right around you.
And this is exactly why AT&T doesn't want net neutrality.
Yeah, that's why we don't want it. And that's why we do want it.
Yeah.
And therein lies the very clear battle. And I think we have a very clear case now, is that when you can cut off an application, it really affects the value of the device you're holding and the connection you have. And it's the freedom of the web that adds value.
According to Pogue's sources, he says Google says it will have exactly the same features as this rejected application. They're not going to lose anything. It'll behave exactly the same as the app would. You can even have the icon on the home screen.
Three cheers for HTML5.
Yay.
Hip, hip, hooray.
Yay.
Let's see it. Let's see it. And before Google releases the new web app, an independent developer at ironicsans.com wrote a little script that creates bookmarklets for each one of your contacts on the iPhone right now. Bookmarklets that you could place on your home screen that will quickly dial your so if you call, I know, isn't this great? I love this. Of course, the independent developer came out with it.
You could just tap that button and it would dial that number.
And it makes the Google Voice call,
free.
Which is fantastic.
Or if it's overseas for pennies.
Right. I'm not sure how it works for SMS messages. The calls aren't free. I mean, you're calling a Google Voice number. So you're using minutes, but the SMS, the text messages are indeed free. And I don't have an iPhone anymore. So I actually didn't try these bookmarklets, but I feel like this is the way. Isn't it funny how we're kind of taking a step back? I mean, remember when the iPhone was first released, Apple was like, well, all you need is the browser.
Right.
And then they, the application platform, and then they rejected an app, and now we're going back to the web browser. But hey,
that's what Chris Messina wrote in his tongue-in-cheek blog post, Steve Jobs Hates the App Store. His secret plan all along was to make apps be so broken and the App Store process so broken that everybody go back to what he really wanted you all to do in the first place, was to write web apps, but nobody nobody wanted to. Let me ask you about HTML5. This WebKit, which is the base for Safari on both the iPhone and the Mac, has really upped their support for HTML. How much of HTML5 is supported now on the iPhone? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I've been a bad web developer and haven't kept on top of the HTML5 feature set and what's out what. But I mean, it seems like every time there's a browser upgrade. In fact, Chrome just released a new beta, right, and saying that they had more HTML5 support. That it's happening incrementally. Interestingly.
Yeah. There you go. Hard to implement, maybe, but not one step at a time. Easy to implement, because you just one tag at a time, you just do. So the whole idea, what is the idea of HTML5?
Well, it lets you create much more dynamic web pages and do things like video and audio without requiring plugins, like the stupid Flash plugin or, you know, that kind of thing, the things that crash browsers. That's the extent of my, like I told you, I've been a bad web developer. That's the extent of my grasp of HTML5 well, right now.
There are a few tags that are really critical. Canvas is one, so that you can draw arbitrarily on the screen. So there are a few tags that they're adding to make it, you know, more, as you say, more possible to create applications. There's a missing piece to the puzzle, though. There's no defined codec for video. And there's some have speculated some that, well, I guess it's an independent process creating HTML5. So no one company could force a proprietary codec on there. Maybe it'll be Ogg Theora or something, some open codec. But as we get closer and closer to that, SVG, for instance, will replace Flash. So all these proprietary technologies kind of are squeezed out of the spec so that it's, in theory, it's fully open.
Mm-hmm.
And then you really do have net neutrality. Nobody can, as long as your browser supports all of these tags, anybody can do, you know, can really do anything they want.
How could you? So just theoretically, how could Apple stop the Google Voice web app?
They could do what Microsoft has done with IE, which is not include certain key tags, but it's too late because they're already in there, I guess. I guess Google believes that they have enough of HTML5 in there to do what they want to do. But you could release a Safari that was dumber.
If they wanted to be really evil, they could probably block calls to and from the Google Voice numbers, because Google Voice just uses a set of intermediary numbers. They're 406, area code 406 numbers. I don't even want to say this.
I can't imagine the FCC would let you get away with that, because what are they going to do? They're going to block calls to the 212 area code because you don't like New York?
Yeah, I mean, that seems
that's the
unlikely.
Of phone network.
Yeah, that seems really unlikely. So, yeah, let's hope that never
happens.
Well,
it would have to be kind of a very aggressive, concerted assault on net neutrality to do it. They'd have to really be ballsy and say, okay, screw you. I don't know why anybody would ever say that, but they could say that. And you're right, that's going to open them to some real risks on Capitol Hill, if nowhere else. Now, Akamai has a very interesting demo. I don't know if you've seen this, and I didn't put it in. I wish I had in the show notes. But it's an iPhone. If you go to iphone.akamai.com, they have a HTTP streaming video for the iPhone. So once again, further, you know, leaving Apple out in the cold. I mean, this is the risk of being too draconian. Is you got a lot of smart people out there who love their iPhones, who say, "All right, we'll do it without you." I mean, if you can do,
we got them where we want them. You know, I think that's the beautiful thing of what's happened with this is that, and it may be that Steve Jobs is smarter than we think and sets this up so that he has cover.
Yeah, maybe Chris Messina's right. Maybe this was the plan all along.
Maybe. Stranger things have happened at Apple.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't put it past Steve. He's a chess player. He thinks more moves ahead than most of us do.
We have a new head of the FCC. We have a new attitude about this. And I think these test cases can be very valuable.
Now's the time. Google, by the way, bought the company, bought On2, which is a video codec company. They've also bought the company that made the Ogg Theora codec. So Google may be up to something there. They may want to own the codec that ends up being an HTML5. The question is, how evil is Google? Would they own it with the idea of keeping it proprietary to themselves, or more likely own it so that others couldn't make it proprietary?
What would Google do, Jeff?
Yeah, what would Google?
I have no idea. But
wait, you wrote the book. Come on. What does it say in here?
I would tend to vote for the latter. Thanks for the plug.
They're not going to do the evil thing.
What's the real business interest there? You know, there's various business interests they have here to it being open. There's also interests in making YouTube more efficient. At this point, you know, incremental savings of bandwidth can make a big difference to get YouTube toward profitability. So I think they have some interest and openness, but I don't know enough.
Hey, supporting your theory, Jeff, that Steve Jobs planned this all along. I didn't realize this. The Akamai streaming site, HTTP TV streaming, is sponsored by Apple. So there you go. That just proves the point. Let's see here. Let me take a break. This would be a good time to take a break before we go on, because we actually have a sponsor on the show. And I think I owe you, Jeff, for this one. Our sponsor is audible.com, and they said, we would love to support the show as long as you plug Jeff's book. So there is Jeff's book. What Would Google Do? It is on audible.com. Did you read it?
Yeah, I did. And you can hear how fast I talk. It was really hard for them in engineering because they had to say all the time, slow down, damn it, slow down.
So the URL is audiblepodcast.com/twig, T-W-I-G. We will invite you to go there and sign up for the gold account that gives you one free book. And, you know, Audible's not going to tell you this. Jeff's not going to tell you this. But it doesn't have to be What Would Google Do? But why not?
Take a free book, then pay for mine. That's fine.
Okay, either way. Now, I think you get paid even if they take the free book. Jeff narrates it. What Would Google Do? Tell us a little bit about the book, Jeff. What's in here? I presumably anybody who listens to a podcast about Google is going to be interested in a book called What Would Google Do?
Well, I'll go against that. It's not really a book about Google. It's a book about the changes in our world, and I figured the one company that has this figured out is Google. And the world has changed more than we even know yet.
Yeah. So Google's kind of the template for the future.
Right. And I think we can learn a lot of lessons from that. And then I have fun trying to apply those lessons to figure out what is a googly restaurant or airline or university.
I love it. I've already screwed it up. The URL is audiblepodcast.com/Google. They throw me every time with these URLs. They change them every time. Sneaky. audiblepodcast.com/Google. What Would Google Do? Could be your first book. Highly recommend it. It really is good. Gina and I are both reading it right now. I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to let Jeff. Yeah. I'm going to let Jeff read it to me.
Yeah, I'm tempted.
Yeah, absolutely free.
To switch to the Audible version.
Yeah, there you go.
On my Kindle,
imagine how hard that editor had to work to get me to sound.
Yeah, on your Kindle, on your iPod, on your iPhone, it works. I think it works on your G1, doesn't it? Do you know?
I think so.
I have to look in the device center. If you go to the Audible site, they have a device center. Let me just see off the top of, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe not, but it does work on a variety of devices. And of course, having a book like Jeff's book along with you wherever you go is really nice. Great way to get through the commute, get through the gym. audiblepodcast.com/Google. Give it a listen. We thank them for their support. And we thank Jeff for his book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have Audible on board. That just shows you. Yeah, I'm actually just going to ask you, this isn't really a Google story. It's a journalism story, Jeff, but I know it's really your beat. Rupert Murdoch says he likes the paywall and all of his sites are going to start charging for news. Is he nuts?
I think it's more that he's suicidal.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you look at the London papers, for example, so fine, put the Times behind the wall. You have the Guardian, for whom I write, the Telegraph, the Independent, all these other papers, and somebody's going to ruin it for them, including, by the way, the BBC, which is never going to go behind a paywall in the UK.
It can't. It already, in a way, it's behind a paywall because you have to pay the license fees for the BBC, right?
Right. In the U.S., so the New York Post goes behind a wall. Well, there's always TMZ. There's always someplace else to tell you that Michael Jackson is strange or now dead. And so I don't think the paywall is going to work. The problem is that we have an industry that refused to update over 15 years since the browser came out commercially and is now in a last minute desperation move trying to fix it all by just saying, well, damn you people, you used to pay, so you should still pay. But it ignores the architecture of the web. It ignores the notion that you should specialize now, that you do what you do best and link to the rest, that you save money that way, and that you lose audience, you lose advertising when you create a wall, and most of all, you lose Google juice when you create a wall. And I think that it really is truly suicidal. And startup companies are going to come along and say, good, please build the wall, and we're going to grab the audience from you.
News Corp's revenues are down almost 50%. Murdoch says, and I can't argue with him, quality journalism is not cheap. And an industry that gives away its content is simply cannibalizing its ability to produce good reporting.
As one blogger said this week, and I wish I could give credit where it was due, in what industry do you approach the economics by saying, well, this is what it cost us to make?
Yeah.
Not my problem.
Yeah.
Not the issue. By these economics, GM should have just raised their prices and everything can be okay.
Right. Well,
clearly not.
No, that's a very good point. You don't sell a house based on what it costs you or how much you put into it. It's just what it's worth.
Welcome to capitalism,
yeah.
Mr. Murdoch.
Now, but he does have one bright shining star, the Wall Street Journal, which is behind a paywall and is doing very well.
The Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times both, because A, you make money from them, and B, you can charge the fee to your employer.
So they're outliers.
And also Bloomberg, too, I think is the best example of that, actually, because the time matters. But in the rest of it, news is mainly a commodity. It's not like selling a song or a movie because you don't want to listen to it 10 times. Information becomes a commodity once it's known. Once you know Michael Jackson is dead, he's just dead. Not to pick on Michael Jackson.
Too late. you're not alone. That's the good news. Google spent $106 million on On2 Technologies, a video compression company. People think that this means that Google would be interested in gaming, but given our conversation about HTML5, I wonder if this has something more to do with HTML5 and streaming video or for YouTube. Any thoughts on the On2 acquisition, Gina? Do you have any thoughts about it?
Yeah, I mean, YouTube would be my first thought, but. This business stuff. I don't know.
Well, they'd like to get. I mean, I think everybody would like to get out from under Adobe's thumb. Flash is so successful. Adobe completely controls that platform. If you took these codecs and open sourced them, it'd be the only way you could really overtake Flash right now on the web. And I think it's in everybody's interest that there be an alternative to Flash. Do you agree?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Every time my browser crashes, I agree even more.
And of course, Steve Jobs is Mr. Anti-Flash, but I think in general, Flash doesn't work well on phones. It's very resource heavy. I mean, everything we do is on Flash. Everything on YouTube is on Flash, except for the stuff.
But it also leads designers to try to overdo things, and that's a problem. I think simplicity in standards is going to be far better than what you can do with something like Flash.
On2 stuff works with mobile phones specifically, as well as set lower powered devices like set-top boxes, internet devices, DVD players. Sony, Samsung both use O2 codecs. Nokia uses O2 codecs. It seems like actually a very good acquisition for Google if for a lot of different reasons. Did you look at the new G2 handsets, Gina, that just came out? What do you think of those?
Oh, I haven't, but I'm lusting from afar. I haven't gotten my hands on one, but they look really neat. Although I did see, I really love the physical keyboard on the G1,
and you do.
And someone who is much better at design and usability than I did this great breakdown of, and I forget, I should look up the name, did this great breakdown of the iPhone virtual keyboard versus the Android virtual keyboard, and kind of said that Android just misses the mark in lots of thousand little ways and makes it a lot less usable. And I have to say, I don't use the virtual keyboard in Android at all. I always go for the physical keyboard. So I'm not sure if the new handsets would do it for me. I'm hoping that they can get the virtual keyboard a little bigger, a little more usable, as usable as the iPhone keyboard. So we'll see. But yeah, I'm thinking about upgrading my handset too.
Do you love Android? I mean, you really think Android is great?
I do. I love Android. Listen,
I mean, I know you support it for political reasons. It's open.
I do. Yes.
But let's say everything is open. Is Android still something you love?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Mostly because of the Gmail client is excellent. The fact that developers can create apps and then they just show up. So the App Store issue. Also, there are things about Android which are really good. I really like the window shade, which is the bit in Android where you can kind of pull down and get notifications, you know, informative notifications versus the iPhone's kind of modal pop-up. I like that it can run processes in the background and push, you know, give me push notifications, that kind of thing. Now, let me just qualify this by saying I was never a full-time Windows Mobile user or Palm user. So my kind of limited view was like I had an iPhone and I was running Symbian on my Nokia. Then I had the iPhone and now I have the G1. So I do really like Android very much.
You know, I was talking to son Jake today, who just got back from Carnegie Mellon, and we were lusting after the idea of a phone of the month club.
Yes, that's what I want.
I visited Best Buy a few weeks ago, and I said, imagine if you could take the fools like me who are, would be willing to spend more money, but not
just send me a new one every month. Yeah,
let's pass it around. We could do our own little Twitch.
We could do it.
Phone of the month club.
Deal.
Right, pass it around.
Deal.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. You know, you get it first because then we can take your, you can tell us how to use it.
It only works with SIMs though. You have to use it either T-Mobile or AT&T because you got to be able to pop the SIM out so I can pass it around, right?
Right. That's it. No, have you gotten the new handset, Leo?
No, I'll get it and I'll send it to you.
That would be great. I'm all over that.
I'll get it and I'll send it to you. But you know, Motorola's got low cost Android handsets coming out. I mean,
what are they coming out, you know?
I don't know. This G2 just came out. I think you can get it now.
Yeah, like last week, right?
Yeah.
This past week.
Right. But the Motorola is, they're just talking about it.
Is anyone going to come out with unlocked ones? There was a manufacturer in Australia that had a great looking one, but at the last minute they had to cancel it because they had the wrong screen resolution. But it was a decent price and it was unlocked. And, you know, if there were a market for Android phones unlocked, full price, I'd go buy two or three. I really would.
That's what I did with the G1. I mean, you know, I didn't unlock it legitimately, but just, you know, send me an email. I'll send you the site where you pay them $20 and get an unlock code. I'm actually running, I've got my AT&T card in my G1. I'm still on my AT&T contract.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's interesting.
I probably shouldn't be admitting this.
No, I think it's fully legal to unlock a phone. Isn't it?
It is. Is it? Okay.
I believe so. Maybe it is. Maybe it's only in France, but it's legal somewhere.
But you only play a lawyer on TV, Lee.
Don't ask me. But no, I believe that the FCC ruled it is legal. Now, remember, the EFF is trying to get the copyright board on app to rule that it's legal to jailbreak. And Apple is the one who sent a brief to the copyright board saying, jailbreak your iPhone, terrorists win.
It sounds like insane.
Sounds like I'm kidding, but they actually said that, which is
that was insane. That was just insane.
Yeah.
Can you imagine having a phone where AT&T service isn't working for you? I mean, that's never happened to anybody.
Shocking. So here's this is interesting. Ben just sent me this in our chat room. This is, go to youtube.com/HTML5. This is a flash free demo of video, high def video.
Ooh.
On YouTube, rendered something with something called O3D, and it looks fantastic, and there is no flash. So that's very YouTube.com. Yeah, isn't that interesting? I guess we're closer than I thought.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Three cheers.
The app shown in the video is coded in JavaScript and HTML. Now, I don't know if this is video of it or if this is actually, maybe this is video. Is this flash video?
It would have to be, right?
I'm looking.
O3D?
Is this flash video of a rendered O3D, or is this, in fact, using no flash? I don't think if I right-click it, I don't get any flash stuff. There's no flash. There's no flash on this. There's no flash on this page. That's very interesting. Boy, that changes everything, huh? And that's in the Safari, which is has a lot of HTML5. I imagine Chrome, it would run even better. What do you think of the new Chrome?
Faster, better. I'm liking it. I'm liking it. I'm sad that Firefox. I mean, the one thing that makes Firefox great, right, is that it's extensible. Is the one thing that makes it so damn slow and is creating this market for, you know, faster, better browsers. I dig Chrome. I like it a lot. I'm actually really interested to see what happens when it becomes as extensible as Firefox.
Somebody said Firefox is the new IE. And
that hurts me because I love Firefox so.
Me too, but I think they might be right.
Oh, God, I feel
like
they're just digging
John Kennedy
work.
Did bad things. You know?
Oh, no, no. Gina doesn't remember him. He was a president long before you were born.
Camelot.
Couple more stories real quickly before we wrap this up. According to TechCrunch, actually TechCrunch quoting a consultant, Google is worth the Google brand, not Google the company, but the Google brand is worth, maybe this is your stat. I won't steal it from you. Is this your stat?
No, it's not. You can get a bonus stat.
This is a bonus stat. Microsoft last year, Microsoft came in second, its brand worth $76 billion. They say the Google brand worth $100 billion, up from $86 billion last year. I don't know how you determine what a brand is worth, but that's what this company does. It's the Brand Z Top 100. Wow.
Yeah, wow.
$100 billion. All right, time for, let's start with, since I just did a stat, we'll let your brain calm down, cool off a little bit. Gina, would you start by giving us your tip of the week?
Yes, I will. This tip is for anyone who runs a blog that has a feed on it, and it will enable PubSub Hubub support in your feed, which means that it will, updates to it will show up immediately in friend feed, at least, and no doubt going forward in other products and Google Reader, I imagine, very soon. So it's good idea to enable it now. And then when support comes in, your updates will go out immediately. You have to be using FeedBurner, which is really great service for managing your RSS feeds. Lots of bloggers already use it. If you log into your FeedBurner console, this option isn't enabled by default, but it's super simple to enable. When you're looking at your My Feeds list, click on the feed that you want to PubSubHubub enable. And under the Publicize tab, there's a list of services on the left side. You want to click on PingShot. And I'm not sure why it's called PingShot. There's no mention of PubSubHubub here. Maybe FeedBurner hates the name as well. I don't know. But if you click on PingShot, you can activate that service. And what that means is that as more services support PubSubHubub, when updates on to your feed happen, they will show up in those services immediately. So it's just a matter of literally clicking a button that says activate there in FeedBurner. And if you do that and republish your feed, hit up friend feed, post next time you do a new post to your blog, and it will show up instantaneously.
Very cool. And besides friend feed, does anybody else support this yet?
Not yet. At the CrunchUp demo, they had a beta version of Google Reader, which did support it, which is not publicly available yet, but they tell me that they're just making sure that Google Reader can handle the load. So I imagine that will roll out soon. It's certainly in testing.
And then, presumably, as more and more people do this, other sites will support it. It's an easy thing for, I think, for the other end to support, right? They just check the...
Yeah, I mean, you have to set up webhooks on the subscriber side, on the subscriber side. So superfeeder.com, which is a service I don't use yet, but I know that it does have PubSubHubub support. And I'm actually going to start hassling the Twitter feed people to maybe get this hooked up as well, because that would be fantastic.
You know, I'm going to give you two tools, because I just realized one of the tools, Dave, we were talking about Dave Weiner earlier, has a great way for adding somebody's Twitter feed to your Google Reader. Have you seen that? Did you play with that? I love this.
He generates an OPML file of all your friends, right? Which is genius. I mean, it makes utter total sense, right? Because every single one of your friends essentially is an RSS feed. And OPML, which is a little less known than RSS, is just a list of subscriptions. So you can, you know, create this OPML file and suck it into your newsreader, and suddenly you're following everyone, you know, within your RSS reader versus Twitter itself.
It's genius. I'm trying to find his post. If you go to his blog, it's probably there somewhere, very easily found. What is the name of it? The service that he wrote that he's using this with this? I've forgotten the name of that too. I'm so bad. I'm getting old. Anyway, I set it up for, he uses an example, Jason Kotke's Twitter feed. I added it to my Google Reader, and it's very cool. You could do this with anybody's follows and see what they see. and put it in your reader, which makes a lot of sense. I'm just scanning through his post to see if I can find it, but I can't.
It's editor.opml.org.
Thank you.
/ Twitter calendar tool.html. And this will show you the tool that will do it for you.
Thank you, Gina.
Sure.
I was going to mention a Google tool, and I hope I can do this every week. I think there are enough tools. I probably won't run out of tools. I don't know if you guys, have you set up your Google profiles yet?
Oh, yes.
You have.
I have.
I love this. And now I think that the time will come at some point. This will make sense to do when Google starts surfacing these in search results. Right now they show up at the bottom. If you search for Gina Trapani at the bottom of the page, you'll see her Google profile. I think it should show up at the top, and I'm lobbying Google to do this.
I agree.
Yeah, because what it does is it gives you control over your Google search results. You could say, these are the canonical search results, the ones I, as the controller of the name Leo Laporte or Gina Trapani, believe you would want to find if you were searching for my name. Have you done this, Jeff?
No, I haven't yet. What happens, it's another Jeff Jarvis, who's a jazz musician. He has the actual talent. And another one who runs Segway tours in Thailand, who has more fun than I do. How do you determine which one of us gets it?
All of them show up.
Yeah, and it's cool, and it includes in the search results kind of like details, like it'll say Jeff Jarvis, New York City, journalist, and versus, you know, so in the search results, people can determine pretty quickly which Jeff they're looking for.
It's kind of like a wiki disambiguation. You can choose which one you want. This is my profile page. If you go to google.com/profiles/Laporte, it uses by default, but doesn't have to, your Google email, your Gmail address. You can have it use something that's a little more obscure, a very long string of letters and numbers instead if you want to be more private. And there's some nice features. You can edit the profile to include an About Me page, some contact info. You could say who could see the contact info based on your groups and your Google Calendar, or rather your Google Voice contacts or your Gmail contacts. You can add companies you've worked for, places you've lived. It puts a little map on the page. It shows all of those. It shows verified domains, which is great. Google does that anyway. I think if you have a Google account, you might have verified some of your email domains. By adding these verified domains, people know these are really yours. It asks about your superpower. What's your superpower, Gina? Do you have one?
It's hyperlinking at the speed of light.
I love that. I say leaps old media empires with a single bound.
There you go.
Which is a little grandiose, but anyway, you can have all your links in there, and you can order them. So I put my Wikipedia article, for instance, up top, then my official bio, then the netcast, and so forth. And this gives you a page that people can go to. It even, I don't know why it has Flickr photos in there, but it even lets you add your Flickr photo stream to it. If you want your Google Latitude, will show up in there. That's because I have that tied to my status message. But it's only visible to people who have my chat buddies. And it has a name verification feature, which I think is great. You can either use a credit card or a phone number. If your phone number is listed, which mine is not, you just enter your phone number. It'll look it up and say, oh, yeah, that's you. Otherwise, you provide it with a credit card. I've already done that for Google Checkout. So it was able to verify that that's me. And that's very handy because now when people search for my name and they find my name in the Google profiles, they can be sure that this is actually the actual Leo Laporte or somebody actually named Leo Laporte. In the case of Jeff, it would be one of the several people who have your name. And then it shows verified email. And this I really like. I don't like giving out my email address, but you can send a message from here and it will end up in my Gmail box. So it's kind of, and it shows up as from the Google profile, which I think is really, really nice. I think this is a tool I would like to see more people use. And then I would like to see Google surface this in the Google results. So it's easy to create one. You know, either search for your name and at the bottom. I think that's what I did is I searched for my name and at the bottom it says your Google profile and you can create it and edit it and do more. Or if you've already got a Gmail account, I think it may show up there. Where else does it show up? I know. Was it the Google Groups, Gina? What do they call that? That it showed up. Kevin Marks showed me how to do it. He was one of the guys behind this. Worth looking into your Google profile, google.com/profiles to find out.
Back to Dave Weiner, he suggested too that the more you could feed that kind of data to search, the more you get personalized search back, and you should be able to tell the search, here's who I am.
Yes.
And there you are.
Yes. It's a way of controlling, you know, somewhat controlling what people see about you. doesn't eliminate the other results, but gives you, but it gives them some like approved, you know, this is what I, you want to find my sites. These are my sites. I used to use a service called Claim ID to do this, but nobody ever heard of Claim ID. This is kind of from Google, so it's a little bit more robust, I think. So that's my tool of the week, Google Profiles. And now it's up to you, Jeff, to make this show actually work with your tip of the week.
Well, I'll do a non-Google stat.
Your stat of
here,
the week, I should say, yes.
Which is from Martin Langveld's Nieman Journalism Lab. He looked at the stats from the National Association of Newspapers and Nielsen on newspaper usage. And it sounds wonderful. 7.8 million unique visitors in June. 3.5 billion page views, 2.7 wow. billion minutes. That all sounds great, right? But Martin then did some stats figuring of his own and came out in a figure that all of that amounted to only 0.56%, a half a percent of online usage went to newspaper sites.
Say that again? Wait a minute.
0.56% of time spent online
Holy
was spent
cow.
On newspaper sites.
Does that include readers, yeah, aggregators, RSS readers, that kind of thing?
Everything according to Nielsen. And it also means that any of the top eight traffic sites on the web, Google, Yahoo, MSN, and all of its various names, Facebook, Fox Interactive, all have more traffic than all newspapers. Each one of them has more traffic than all newspapers combined. Now, why the hell does this have to do with Google? I think it goes back to what Gina was saying earlier about a cloud architecture. And the notion that people have to come to your site all the time is just over. And it's why, by the way, Mr. Murdoch, charging isn't going to work because you're too small. And the only way you're going to succeed in a competitive world of advertising is by getting bigger. And the only way you're going to get bigger is by distributing yourself and making yourself embeddable on other people's sites. And we'll see whether any newspapers actually do that. But if they thought like Google, that wasn't a plug, they would try to figure out how to get themselves out there more, because this just shows how tiny they really are.
Yeah. Wow. No kidding. And put up a paywall? Are you going to grow or are you going to shrink?
Exactly.
0.5 to 0.05 to nothing.
You milk the cow until she dies.
It won't take long at this rate. What Would Google Do is Jeff's book. You can find it in bookstores or get it on Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Google and get it for free when you sign up for the gold account. audiblepodcast.com/Google. Gina Trapani's at smarterware.org. Or just look for a profile, Google Profiles. It's profiles.google.com/Gina Trapani. And,
yep.
you and your sister are so cute.
Thank you.
I'm looking at your pictures now. This is so much fun. But you,
thanks.
Yeah, it's really.
And just a little tip, you know, the Flickr integration is great, but you can actually create a feed of just pictures of yourself, you know, headshots.
Oh, you can?
You know, yeah. And then you can tell your Google profile, just pull pictures from this set that I approve. So you can pretty.
So you're doing kind of headshots, because mine have a lot of right. tourist shots. So this is all pictures exactly. of Gina, which is actually, you're right. That's what it should be.
Right,
so
right.
So that you could have, you know, you could have your headshots there and stuff. Very cool. But you haven't verified your name, Gina.
I have it. I was a little leery about the whole credit card situation. I'm not hooked up with Google Checkout yet, but I should do the phone number thing.
You trust Google, don't you?
I do trust them. I just thought that the whole, honestly, when I set up my profile, I didn't see the option to verify my name. And then I saw that cool little green banner on yours and another reader of mine. And I said, hey, how'd you do that? And then it's some roundabout process. You have to go through like Google Null.
That's what it is. Not groups. Null. You have to have a Null account.
That's it. And like, who has a Null account? I love Google.
I didn't have a Null account. This Null was Google's attempt to create like a Wikipedia or a Mahalo or something. And it's just a crazy idea. But so I created a Null account, and then as soon as you create an account, it says, oh, you want to verify your name?
Yeah, they need to streamline the name verification process a little more on Google Profiles,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. The whole thing, as with many Google projects, feels like kind of a redheaded stepchild that's so close to being something really, really useful if they would just give it some attention.
At 20% time, man.
It probably is a 20% project, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It probably is. Well, hey, once again, another fantastic show. Really fun to talk to you both. Smarterware.org for Gina. Buzzmachine.com for Jeff. I'm Leo Laporte. I think you could probably figure out where to find me. Just Google me. And Google Twit. That still works for the time being anyway. And we'll see you next time. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this show by going to iTunes and searching in the iTunes store for Twig this week in Google. Or just go to our Twit TV page, which is in the podcast providers section on the left there. Also in the Zune store and everything, we have it at twit.tv. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Cue the classical music. Thank you.